spend my dollar.
It's not about what you want. It's about what you're willing to do to get it. Run it again.
Hello and welcome.
I'm not going to, so quit asking.
When you give me a hard time.
For the listeners that didn't get to go.
This is the payback.
Alabama wins!
What you did last year really doesn't matter.
Our goal is to have the kind of team that nobody wants to play.
Hi.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Alabama Football Podcast. You know what? We have a unique halftime show today, so let's just jump straight into the action without further ado. And I'm going to tell you what, this Alabama offense is prolific. It is dangerous. It is a joy to watch. Alabama put up 45 points in the first half, which is by itself sort of an amazing stat. I don't know that I've ever recall seeing that. In seven possessions in the first half, and I'm not counting the 1 second possession where the team just took a knee going into half, not counting that. That would be an eighth possession. But the seven true, authentic possessions that Alabama had in the first half, the Tide managed to score 6 touchdowns and 1 field goal and had right at 500 yards of total offense. It was 492. Those are numbers that would make you happy at the end of a game. Those were numbers that were true and real at the end of the first half. Just phenomenal. This Alabama team is going to be a piece of work. This Alabama team is going to be very tough to contend with. It already is. I'm saying going to be when we start thinking about the teams in the playoffs or the periphery of the playoffs. We have Florida coming up in the SEC championship. And then if you think of sort of the Clemson, the Notre Dame, and the Ohio State contenders, if you will, for the playoffs, they all have to be looking at this Alabama team with a little bit of, wow, those guys are really good. And we know that, and we're enjoying the heck out of that. But I think other teams are really starting to take notice if they haven't already. You know, LSU is a team, and we're going to get into this. LSU is a team that we can throw a lot of darts at. We can say that they've lost a lot at coaches from last season. True statement. They've lost a lot of players from last season. True statement. They don't have probably the best coach in the conference, in the country, probably not even a top 10 coach. And I think we would all agree with that. However, what's also true is if we were to take the LSU talent and we were to have some sort of obstacle course or some sort of combine where we're measuring athleticism, this LSU team would perform very well in that regard, especially some of their younger, talent. They do have athletes. They do have some quality players. They're just not all bringing it together. They're not gelling together into a championship level team. I don't think that this team has the talent to be a champion this year, but they have the talent to be much more competitive than they are. And so I put that on their coaching. But when we talk about this game and the things that we're seeing or did see or didn't see in this game, let's not lose sight that the LSU team is talented. They're not put together in a team construct, maybe as they should be, but the athleticism is there. The talent is there. And I think we'll see that potentially over the next couple of seasons. But let's celebrate this Alabama team because that's what we're here to do. Alabama put up 55 points, held LSU to 17 points. I think I saw, people clipping stuff from message boards, and I think I saw something where an LSU fan said, you know, LSU, we need to be excited that we scored 17 points on Alabama and held them to 55. So I thought that was kind of funny. I like our side of that coin. But I thought that was sort of I got a kick out of that. When we think about the offensive side of the ball for this Crimson Tide squad, I think of the big three, and not in a Dallas Cowboys kind of way when it was Aikman, Emmitt, and Irving, although those are three NFL Hall of Famers. But when we think about the Alabama squad, I think of Mack, Najee, and Smitty. And they all had phenomenal days. There was enough production certainly to go around. Mac Jones was 20 of 28 for 385 and 4 touchdowns. Najee was 21 carries for 145. He had 3 touchdowns. And then Smitty, shares some stats with Mac, but he had 8 catches. It's amazing that he only had 8 catches for prolific a day as dominant of a day that he had, but he had 8 catches for 231 yards and 3 touchdowns, which is amazing. He had 3 touchdowns on 8 carries, or 8 catches. Almost half of his catches resulted in touchdowns, which is amazing. And of course, he definitely had some incredible catches sort of mixed in the bag there. When we think about this big three, and we step back and we kind of look at it from another angle, what if we were to look at it from the angle of the Heisman Trophy, right? If you were to script, not just this year, but any year, you were to script, hey, who would we, in a best case scenario, and I know it's done by voting, but if we could have the 5 top best candidates, and I know this year they're not going to New York and all that, so let's just say top 5 candidates, how would you kind of break them down? And you might sort of say, recognizing this is more often than not an offensive category, an offensive award, you might say, well, let's look for the top 3 quarterbacks, because it is more of a quarterback award, even offensively. Let's look at the top running back, and let's look at the top wide receiver. And if we do that, that's going to be a pretty representative construct. And if it's in an anomaly year and we need to shift that a little bit, or there's some defensive player, whatever, then we can do that. But if the model is we're going in thinking top 3 quarterbacks, top running back, top wide receiver, then that's going to be a very talented room that we're going to have when it comes to sort of the finalists and the final selection. So if you use that as a criteria, which I don't think is unreasonable, if you use that as a criteria, well, guess what? Alabama's big three shows up. Mac Jones clearly going to be one of the top 3 quarterbacks. I think Kyle Trask is going to be on there. I think Sunshine at Clemson is on there as well. There's maybe some argument that his play hasn't been that good. Maybe there's some argument. People like Ian Book. That's fine. If you get to the 3rd quarterback, I'll let you sort of select who that is. But I think Trask and Mac are going to be the top 2 quarterbacks. But if you go out looking, hey, let's go find the number 1 running back. And there's going to be some metrics in there. It's going to be caliber of play. Right. So we're probably not going to go get that guy at SUNY Buffalo, even though he's been tearing up the yardage, because it's just level of competition. You're going to look at some stats, touchdown production relative to peers. And then you're just going to look for big plays, big sort of moments. And I think Najee performs well on all of those. Certainly the touchdowns. He leads the nation in rushing touchdowns. Routinely putting up, 2-3 touchdowns a game, or seemingly so. And, big runs, a lot of highlight opportunities when you look at a Najee. And then when you go wide receiver, you can't not go Smitty. I think he has 16 receiving touchdowns. Maybe it's 15 receiving touchdowns on the season. I think the number 2 leading touchdown receiver in college football has 10. Maybe you could argue there's a little bit of imbalance because of schedules and teams not playing. But you know what? Whose fault is that? It's not Smitty's. And so the numbers are what the numbers are. There's a significant sample size. If there were an outstanding caliber receiver somewhere else, then they would rise to the top. And the differential between Smitty and the rest, I think, is pretty clear there. And so what's interesting when you think about the Alabama Big Three and you step away and you look from, what might a model room, a model top 5 be from a Heisman perspective, it's pretty damn amazing that it's going to be Alabama's top 3 are going to be in that 5. That is just that to me, that is amazing. And if we want to continue the Heisman talk just a little bit farther, I'm going to go out on a limb here. I call it a conditional prediction. I think there's a path to Smitty winning the Heisman Trophy. Now, I said at the beginning of the season that sort of a prediction at the beginning of the season is that Alabama would have multiple, maybe not finalists, but multiple contenders for the Heisman Trophy. When the votes were counted, I said that Jalen Waddle would have the highest vote count, and also predicted that no one from Alabama would win the Heisman because they're going to fragment the voters. If you have 2 or 3 people from the same team, sometimes if you have 2 or 3 people from the same region, because voting is national, and there's sort of regional sort of cliques, if you will, that that can fragment the voting. So I didn't think that anyone from the from the Alabama would win, and Alabama having multiple candidates may make it tough for other candidates from the South, to have a legitimate shot. And so that kind of paved the way maybe for other candidates. I think there's truth to that. I think all of that, I still sort of have an element of truth to, and I'm actually counting on some of that when I pave my path for Smitty to have a shot for winning the Heisman, not predicting that he will win it, but conditionally, here's what it would take. Without question, everyone looks for a Heisman moment. And Smitty's sort of piece de resistance, or Smitty's Heisman moment, was that one-handed grab in the end zone against LSU. If you've not seen that, stop the podcast and go find it. It's the Google machine will have it. That catch was phenomenal. It may go down as one of the most athletic catches we've ever seen by an Alabama wide receiver. And, you know, sort of at me if you think someone, if you can think of another play, a different play, because I'd love to have that conversation, because I like talking Alabama football, not confrontational so much as just a damn fun topic. That catch was just phenomenal. Even amongst his other catches, and he's had some great ones, that stands out. That is an amazing catch. And so with that, he has a Heisman moment that is probably singularly better than anyone else's. When you distill it down to a single play, think of Charles Woodson winning the Heisman. I'll show my age a little bit, but think of Charles Woodson winning the Heisman as a defensive back, and he had returned some kicks, and he beat out Peyton Manning, which is still sort of a travesty. I think Peyton sort of deserved the award that year. But the plays that stuck out were the return kicks that Woodson had, and especially, you know, when he sort of struck the pose a couple of times. And so he had that singular moment. And without question, Smitty had that against LSU. Now, what is it going to take? I don't think that alone gets him there. But think about this. And this plays into the Charles Woodson, and it also plays exactly into why I thought Waddle would be the leading vote getter for Alabama. Obviously, he's out with injury. Imagine a world where Alabama plays a team, a highly ranked, well-regarded team that also has a Heisman candidate on that team. Imagine a world where that's a highly meaningful game. Oh, kind of like the SEC championship game against Florida in a couple of weeks. Imagine a world where Smitty is returning punts. Oh, he is returning punts because of Waddle's injury. Now, one last thought leap. Imagine it's a relatively close game. And imagine Smitty makes a big punt return for a touchdown. Maybe that's not the punt return that ices the game. Maybe those 6 points aren't the margin of victory. Maybe it's still a 14-16 point win for Alabama, but those are six of the points. Just imagine that. Would that be enough to sway voters to Smitty? I'm not going to definitively say yes, but damn, that would be compelling. When everything looks like, these quarterbacks, I mean, they're all really good, but they all kind of look alike. What's different? Show me the difference. Those would be two wow difference moments that Smitty has. The catch against LSU, and in this imaginary scenario, the punt return against Florida. Would that be enough to win him the Heisman? Maybe so. Maybe so. Definitely something to watch out for. That makes me excited sort of thinking about it. And again, I'm not rooting for a close game against Florida where we need a punt return to win it. But you talk about having tricks up your sleeve. That's a mighty interesting one for me. All right, so let's move away from the big three at Alabama, because you could spend a lot of time talking about those guys, and most everyone is. I want to give just a continued shout out to Jahlil Billingsley, his emergence on the scene the last, what is it, 3 weeks since the double barrel bye weeks, his emergence, you know, we said coming out of the bye, and then we had a second week, and we said, you know, one of these youngsters is going to emerge, and it's going to be Javon Baker, and it's, you know, that's going to be that extra little something. Well, it's been Jahlil Billingsley, and he continues to perform well, and he continues to play well, and he's an explosive factor. You think of a tight end, you think of, you know, maybe the Waylon Meyer at A&M is kind of what you think about. Jahlil's have got a little more juice than that, and he is a treat to watch, and he creates all sorts of matchups. And on, you know, on the field, draws coverage away from the other receivers. He continues to grow and evolve. And this is a guy we need to really keep our eyes on, number 19 on offense, because, you know, he's starting to really get into the rotation. He had four catches against LSU for 68 yards. He certainly had a touchdown, which is phenomenal. But you know what he also had? He also was the go-to target on a 4th-and-1. And so Alabama's third. And so talk about just the confidence that the coaching staff has in him, that they're going to go to him, you know, not on a first down sort of in the middle of the field, but on a 4th-and-1, we're going to go to target Jahlil Billingsley. And it was a phenomenal catch. Mac rolled out. Jahlil had gone sort of across the formation, and Mac threw the ball. You know, kind of running and jumping through the ball, hit him on the, and sort of on his back hip, on Jahlil's back hip. And that's a tough catch. He's moving away from the ball. The ball's coming at sort of an odd angle. It's not hitting him in the hands. He has to go get it. And Jahlil looks very fluid making that catch. He looks fluid running his route. He looks fluid going back and getting the ball. He looks like just a bigger version of a very talented wide receiver. He's fast. He's agile. He's nimble. Good hands demonstrated on a catch like that. I can't sing enough praises of Jahlil Billingsley. And so, you know, kind of continue from there. What's interesting is he caught that catch on 4th down. The next play, I believe I'm right. The next play, he had four catches on the day. On that third touchdown drive, he had two consecutive catches. One was on the 4th-and-1 to preserve the drive, maintain possession of the ball, and then the next play was a touchdown pass to Jahlil. So that's phenomenal. Tip of the cap to Billingsley. Again, you know, continue to not be able to say enough about the offensive line. The time that they give Mac is just amazing. It's impressive. This may well be one of the best offensive lines we've had at Alabama. I know there's been a lot of talk to comparing it back to, what is it, to 2011, 2012 offensive line. That was a savage bunch as well. Landon Dickerson is just, he is a beast. He's a character. He's a hoot. And he is mean as a snake on the field. In the context of the game and within the context of the rules, but he is a treat to watch. I hope some of what he has washes off on some of the youngsters on the team. You like, you know, at least one of the linemen to be known as sort of just mean and vicious, again, within the construct of the game. But I think Landon is that, and I hope some of that kind of washes off on the other guys. Incredible amount of high praise on the offense, and I think that is the takeaway. I'd be remiss if we didn't call out a couple of opportunities that were left on the field. Slade Bolden saw some action. He ran a crossing route, caught a nice pass, I believe it was a 19-yard gain, and across midfield, getting the ball down to the 26. However, he wasn't careful with the ball and had it sort of batted out from his arms there. And so I don't know if that's a function of him getting limited practice. And so all sort of the ball control drills, possession drills that they do, did he not get as much of that? I do not know. It's just pure speculation. But that's something that I feel confident that Slade will get corrected. But that's something that we want to call out as an opportunity there. On the field goal, one of the field goals, I believe it was Alabama's first field goal, there was an incomplete pass to Smitty, and would have liked to have seen that catch made. That may have been the second field goal that Bryce threw because he had pretty good coverage. Looked like Stingley was going to get it. Wonder if maybe they should have even, you know, Bryce should have even thrown that ball. I thought Smitty had a really good opportunity at it, but didn't come down. That potentially could have been a score. And then on the punt, Alabama's lone punt, which was a good punt, by the way, but the lone punt of the day, there was an incomplete pass to Mechie. And I know and that was sort of the down the field. So why were we taking the down the field strike? There's good and bad in this play, right? We're taking this, it's third and short, and we're taking fourth and short. It's third and short because we kick a field goal. And so we sort of heap the ball. I know we punted. We heap the ball up down the field, really into double coverage. And so you think, Mac, what are you doing? What are you doing? And the ball really kind of hit Mechie in his hands, in his basket, could have caught it, should have caught it, would have been a tough grab with all the sort of not pass interference, but all just the interference of the defenders there. But the placement of the ball is like throwing it into, a small bucket, 30 yards down the field. It was amazing. Just the play, a moving bucket at that, just the placement on that ball was pretty darn incredible. Wish Mechie could have pulled that in, but those are the things that these players can work on. Smitty and Mechie, as good as they are, they continue to have things that they can work on. Slade. So it looks like the receivers there have some opportunity to work on, but still it's hard to get mad at anything on the offensive side because just the dominance and just the prolific explosion that this team put on the board. Again, 45 points at half, pretty darn amazing. So let's go mini game ball on offense. And I'm going to go to Emil Ekior. I think Emil has improved his game over the course of the season. I think, you go back to the Missouri game, that feels like so long ago. He may have been the weak link across the offensive line. I'd hesitate to still call him the weak link on the line today. I guess if someone had to be, then we could have that conversation. But it was much more apparent, let's call it the first week of the season. But he's hung in there. He's continued to fight, continued to battle, continued to improve. And I think he's an anchor, one of the anchors across the offensive line. And I think he's positioned himself very, very well to be a stalwart across the line coming back, certainly next year, perhaps years to come. But here's what stood out to me. There was a play that really sort of captured my imagination with Ekior, and so thus the mini game ball. Alabama was deep in their territory. I believe this was after a turnover. Ball on the 8. It was a 2nd and 13, so not an insignificant play. Alabama's playing a 2nd and 13 on the 8, and the pass is completed to Mechie for a 13-yard gain to convert the first down. But on the play, and this doesn't happen often, but on the play, Landon Dickerson got beat. Now, what's interesting is we see a lot of plays that landed is maybe blocked his man and he's sliding over to help someone out, or he's sliding out sort of headhunting someone to knock on their tail. And in this play, it was almost sort of a role reverse. Landon got beat, and as the guy was coming around on Landon, Ekior was looking for someone to block, had his head on a swivel, and he saw that Landon was about to get beat. And so he ran over, and he didn't deplete the guy, didn't knock the guy over, didn't make anything that's going to make a highlight reel play, but he occupied the pass rusher so Mac could step up and complete the pass. Had Ekior not stepped in on that 2nd and 13 at the Alabama 8, pinned back in our territory, if he had not stepped up and made that block, then Mac either has to rush the ball out of bounds just to get rid of it. Potentially there's a sack, creating, a really long third down situation. So again, I'm not going to project what would have happened had the block not been made. But what wouldn't have happened would have been the conversion for the first down, and could have gone, completely a different way. I want to say that ended up being a scoring drive. Do I have it in my notes? It was the first drive for a field goal. So that was a scoring drive. And so that was one of Alabama's longest drives in terms of number of plays, time of possession, and yardage covered. So that ended up being one of the scoring drives. And so hats off to Emil Ekior for helping to preserve one of the scoring drives. All right. So I promised that we're going to do something a little bit different in halftime. So rather than hear me, this is a better or worse, probably a lot better, I think. Instead of hearing me sort of read an ad roll, what we have today is I had the opportunity to sit down with one of the founders of Legends Drinkware, and we sort of had a conversation/interview and talking about how they got into sort of making the glasses, how they got into selecting Alabama. You're going to learn a little bit more about Stefan, one of the founders. You're going to hear a little bit more about sort of the drive, the passion that they have to their product. You know what? Let me tell you this. I listen to a lot of podcasts as well, and there's sort of a career coach that I listen to. And one of the things that I used to listen to anyways, one of the things that he said that was always sort of a kick for me that sort of resonates is, you know, authentic selling is the transference of enthusiasm. And so when I talk about Legends Drinkware, I hope that enthusiasm is coming across, that I'm not just showing a product, but I have sort of genuine enthusiasm in the product. And so it's with that truth in mind that let's go ahead and roll the tape. But I share my conversation with Stefan for Legends Drinkware. I'll be back after this and we'll finish the show. Roll Tide.
Is it the one you go for when you're drinking stuff, or is it the special evening one?
Well, it's both. It's the one that I look for. It's the one that I look for first. I have, I'll tell myself a little bit. You said two of them. So I still have one of them that I haven't unwrapped yet.
Oh, wow. And, nice.
Yeah. So I've kind of opened it a little bit. I did, you know what? I did an opening show and tell on one of our Zoom calls, but I haven't used it yet. And over the summer, I had sort of a run over the summer of breaking glasses. And I was like, now I'm getting the nicest glasses I've had, and I don't want to break them. So I said, I'm going to put one on the shelf, and then I'll have one, and I've got sort of whatever other glasses that I use if this one's still in the wash or whatnot. But yeah, this is the go-to. This is absolutely awesome. Absolutely the go-to.
I love it. Yeah. That's what it's all about. We're very glad to make people happy. And the show has been going well. Obviously, it's pretty crazy year. Cancellations and Saban. He's got it. He doesn't have it. He miraculously got rid of it again, thankfully.
Right.
Pretty wild.
I don't know. I think probably it's hard to know, right? They test every day. And did he have it or not have it? I'm of the mind that he didn't really have it. You know, for the Georgia game, that was probably a false positive, because he took, you know, subsequent testing, and that cleared up pretty soon. I think there was something that he had that this more recent time, and whether he had a positive while he had sort of a runny nose, and I don't know. I guess that I'm not a medical expert. I mean, if he had it, he needs to be quarantined, and I'm not trying to sort of buck any of the system there, but. I was like, man, a runny nose in November, you know?
Yeah, unheard of. Yeah, so definitely.
But he sat out some time, it looks like he's going to be back for this game, so that's good. That's good. Sark did a good job last week, so.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if he's, you know, he's a great coach, he just has a little problem with the sauce. If I remember his time in Washington, I think, or whatever it was. But, yeah. It's good to see that he's can return to head coach status and keep it together. So that makes me happy for sure. That makes me happy.
Yeah, absolutely.
And in the COVID world down there is it like escalating crazy style, or is it?
You know, here where we are here in Atlanta, I think the numbers are starting to, you know, tick back up, and I don't know where it's gonna kind of plane out, but it seems that, you know, as soon as it starts trending a little bit better and people go out and think that it's done, then there's sort of another wave, right? And so I don't know. I guess it'll be interesting. And then you get into sort of the regular flu season, and so how does that sort of, you know, commingle the confusion? I don't know. I what's interesting, and my wife and I talk about this, like I take it serious, right? I do. It's a serious thing, and everyone should take it serious. Not everyone does, but everyone takes it serious. What's sort of tricky about it is some people will have it and it won't bother them at all, and then some people will die from it. And it's like, wow, that's a pretty wide range of. And so, you know, on a day over day basis, I want to think it's no big deal, but you can't sort of take that. And so, I don't know. Sometimes I'll answer a question more flippantly, and it'll sound like, oh, he's one of those people that doesn't take it serious. but that's not true. it's just a weird thing. I don't know.
It's so weird. Yeah, it's just like literally you have it, didn't know it, it passed through, you're fine. And then someone else, you know, granted, even obviously it's definitely picking off the older generation, but I've heard, you know, first-hand accounts of people in their 40s and, you know, mm-hmm. just cannot shake this thing, doesn't know what happened, thought they were going to die, writing their goodbye letters on their, you know, their notes in their phone and, yeah, and right. the long haulers and all that stuff. But it is, yeah, and then you forget that it's a pandemic. You're like, no, actually, this is happening. This is still happening. It's wild. But, yeah, we're just going to play safe, play smart, and hope that these vaccines are what they tout them to be. And we'll move on to getting back to some semblance of normalcy.
Right. How has this impacted you guys? How has it impacted your business?
You know, luckily, the studio where we make this it's massive. It's like a airplane hangar. So we can have separate areas for people and their teams that work together and everybody is being very responsible and they have their own. So when you're blowing, there's like you have pipes and tubes and all stuff. So you have everybody has their own stuff essentially. So you might cross when you're gathering glass or something else, but it allows us to maintain, you know, safety precautions. And as far as growth, and it would have been better in a lot of ways if we could have been on the ground at a lot of these schools to launch, but it's also been a slog trying to get as many schools approved as we wanted. The licensing companies that own them, like Learfield IMG, pretty much they own 100 licenses. They're like the big one. They've been around for a long time. They own most of the radio stations, rights, all that stuff. And there's a smaller company that owns a couple, but it's just been, they've been very slow with the approval process. We've been working on some of these schools. We're working on the Oregon State for like 7 months and they finally got back to us like a week ago. All right, you're approved. So the slow growth, the slow organic growth is definitely the way, you know, it's actually probably a good thing so we can figure things out.
Right.
Because it's not just we get the proof and then we hit go and move forward, but it's been good. You know, we're definitely slow and steady. You know, it's marketing is challenging because you can't cast like a super wide net. With Facebook has been tricky, so we're actually starting to target more. We're about to launch a whole campaign on a local or an Oregon sports network, like the number of the station that broadcasts all the Ducks games. We just signed on to that, so that should be pretty exciting because instead of casting wide net, we're targeting exactly who are, yeah, the people that are the diehards that are listening to the radio that are, you know, on their lunchtime or whatever it is, and they can't get enough. And so we're pretty excited. They cut us a pretty sweet deal. So
nice.
We're excited to, and we're trying to figure out what the best combination of marketing and way to reach our audience is. So baby steps forward, but exciting stuff. We definitely see the potential and hopefully, you know, we hope to have maybe 30 schools by the end of 2021, maybe more. You know, we're just going to keep stacking them up and keep pushing forward. So exciting stuff. Yeah, it's been fun. It's been fun.
Cool.
But challenging.
Well, hey, talk about, I'm going to segue into questions that I have here, right? And so, Stephen, talk to us about, you know, sort of your background. Talk to us actually about, you know, how you guys got started, right? I was looking at your website and it read like a glass blower and a sports marketer walk into a bar and out springs, you know, Legends Drinkware, right? So how I like that vision in my head, but how close to reality? How did you guys really get started?
Very, very close to that. It's three of us actually. I've known the other two grew up together and they're from St. Louis. They've known each other since crib. I've known them for over 20 years. They're just incredible artists, and I've been working in collegiate sports marketing for just about 20 years as well with the University of Alabama. You know, we've done a ton of stuff down there. As I've mentioned to you, we were the first company that I worked for at one point that installed all the LED signage in Bryant-Denny Stadium. So before they had that LED board running along the sidelines 100 yards long, that wasn't there till our company put it in, and we made all those fun graphics, the Go Fight Win, right. Boom Hours, you know, all that kind of fun stuff. And we build those graphics and really got to taste the experience. So we had been talking for a little while about being able to bring something incredible to sports fans, something special, because we just didn't feel like it existed. You can get your, there are nice stuff and there are cool things, but there's nothing new that's really happened in sports merchandise for a long time. Maybe a pop socket is kind of new. But other than that, there's nothing really that new that you can find on Fanatics or whatever it is. So, we decided to take what we thought would be magnificent and change the game a little bit and create something for the end user, something that you can enjoy on a daily basis. Not something that the only time you're going to see your hat or your shirt is when you look in a mirror and you're like, hey, look at me. I look pretty good. You are the sports fan. You are the passionate one. You are the one that is torn over that they're going to make this fourth and long, whether they're going to do score a touchdown, whether they could go to the championship, how the season's going to go. So we felt that that person should be the one that gets to enjoy the logo in all its glory in a new way that they haven't seen before. So we just started kicking out prototypes. The reason we started with the University of Alabama is that I've been working with them for about, you know, since 2001-ish. And I've grown very close with a lot of the people that work at Crimson Tide Sports Marketing in the stadium. My first game was 2005 against Middle Tennessee State, big rival. But it was, you never forget your first time at Bryant Denny, but you really don't forget this one because it was 3 days after Katrina. And I was down there and we were like, are we going? We're not going. And we were there and they had turned all like the gyms into places for displaced families to go. You know, FEMA meetings in our parking lot. We were driving in. I think we flew into Birmingham or something like that. You just saw all the destruction that had taken place. And it was just a crazy, crazy time to be there. The emotions were heavy. They had stickers on their helmets because everyone's family, you know, was just displaced. And I actually volunteered. So I was like, I got to do something. I went down to, it was one of the rec centers and volunteered and was making instant grits for some people. And I was like, I'm here. I got to do something. And it was a really, you know, heavy time to be there, but a really magical time to be there as well. It was also my first time at Dreamland Barbecue, which is always magical.
All right.
I've been around, but you know, we knew that if we couldn't do Alabama, we really didn't want to do this at all. If you can't get the best, why even mess with the rest? So we put in a ton of time and really tried to dial it in the best we could, and you know, the end result has been something sensational. You know, as you guys have known, you've seen, you've experienced, it's a pretty special experience to have. We made something that's such an essential part of life, drinking, like liquids. We are humans. We need liquids, you know, whatever kind, for better or for worse, to get us through the day. It's essential to sleep, and it's something that's taken for granted. People don't really think about it too much. We wanted to create value and experience in something you do so often, and it just made sense that we could make this spectacular glass that represented pride, tradition, and excellence that you could hold in the palm of your hand and you can enjoy every single day, whether that's Saturday, whether that's March, whether that's whatever day of the week it is, you can celebrate your team and enjoy them whenever you want. We went just like, you know, you said you wanted to grab a glass. This is the first glass you look for. Why not? You know, we all need a little extra joy in our days during this COVID time as well. So if there's like a little extra way for us to connect with our fan base, our people, something that just makes the simplest part of life a little bit more meaningful, that's really something we're glad to contribute to this, the current day environment.
Right. You know, what you said is exactly right. You can get hats and shirts and shoes and sweatshirts and sweatpants and everything that has, you know, your team's logo on it. And you can get, you know, drinkware that has, you know, it's sort of emblazoned, you know, on the outside. What I think is cool is almost the unexpected nature of, you know, the placement. And the closest thing maybe I can liken it to is I used to have a Harley Davidson, and everywhere you looked on the bike, you would see the little shield. And if you were taking off the cover on the, you know, to put air in the tire, or you were tweaking, you know, a bolt, or you'd take the gas lid off and you know, to fill it up. There was something in there that had, you know, the logo, and it just made you feel like, cool, you know, I'm part of, you know, this, I enjoy it. It's part of sort of identify with it, and to see the logo sort of everywhere. And the glass is cool because there is an unexpected, you know, how many drinking glasses do you have that have, you know, something on the bottom? I think when I was a kid, I had a bowl that had, you know, the Flintstones in the bottom. And it's been that long ago since, you know, I want to get to the bottom so I can see the Flintstones. And, you know, the glasses, you know, they have that. It's a super slick logo. And there's just enough sort of unexpectedness to the placement that I think makes it cool. And then you talk about, and it's probably sports fans in general, I think college football and this is true, there's a we element. We don't talk about the team as them. We talk about the team as us. We talk about the team as we. And so anything that you have that has the logo that makes you feel, you know, that much more connected to, you know, ultimately, I guess the product, then, you know, there's satisfaction to be derived from that. And as far as I'm concerned, you guys, you know, hit the ball out of the ballpark on that one. That's, you know, that's really cool. Talk about sort of the glass blowing process, right? And you know, and how you sort of get the logo into the bottom. I probably have sort of a mental snapshot of how it works, but I don't have any of the jargon. Sort of educate us a little bit, make us feel cool about, you know, how that process works. I think when I was a kid, I got all these stories when I was a kid. I think it was when I was a kid, I went to Pigeon Forge and Silver Dollar City, and they had sort of some guy, you know, sort of blowing glass, you know, sort of an exhibit. I don't think he was really making anything, but it was just, you know, sort of a tourist thing. And so when I think of blowing glass, I think of this hillbilly guy, you know, blowing glass at Silver Dollar City back in 1982. It's probably much cooler than that, actually. Talk about that process, how you guys blow the glass and make these cool glasses.
It is a super fascinating and engaging art to watch. You know, sometimes watching people paint isn't that cool. Sometimes making pottery, you know, the end result's amazing, but sometimes the actual process isn't that engaging. But glass blowing is just so captivating. The studio that we have is in Portland, Oregon, and pretty much all of the machinery in it was built by my partners. They're very smart guys, engineering, artistic brains, where, you know, from the kilns to the glory holes to everything in the shop they have built, which boggles my mind because I'm somewhat smart, but the way they're like, yeah, we just build that, we just da 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 da. The glory hole is this. It's kind of there.
Yeah, you gotta explain that.
Yeah. So there, it's kind of like a vessel that contains glass in it, and then it has all these rings of different sizes, so it allows essentially, and there's hydraulics, so you can open up. There's the set of rings to allow to get more glass or less glass out of this pot of vat of molten hot glass. So it is just, you know, funny name, but it is pretty useful, and it's pretty magnificent the way they just hydraulicize everything. But essentially the process here, we use eco-friendly glass. There's no lead in it. It's just as strong and a little bit lighter than leaded glass. And it's a mix of a couple different types of glass to create the look and quality that we're shooting for. And you gather the glass a couple of times. You have to blow a little bit of a bubble in it. You know, sometimes you'll see it on PBS and they'll blow it and it'll be like this massive, massive bubble. We start off with a smaller one and really just try and shape it. And then essentially we gather the glass a couple more times to put some more on it, keep it warm, and then we blow it out, and then you actually like swing it back and forth to elongate the glass. It's just wild. It looks like liquid. And then we built, you know, we've kind of created this on our own because this hasn't really been done before. That's the other unique thing about us, is that in this world, it's rare you find a product that didn't exist. It's always a variation on something. Sure, glasses did, but a glass like this, no, this was never done before. So there's a mold, essentially, with doors that open on top of it, and we stand on a platform, and then the glass is on this long rod, and then they blow into it, and they slowly, when the temperature's right, they drop the rod and the glob of glass into, they open these doors, and then they drop it into the mold. and they hold it there, then they close the doors on top of it, and they blow into it, and they stretch it out, and you have to wait till the time's exactly right, and then you hit the pull a couple times to shake it loose, and then you wiggle it when it's just right, the temperature's right, and then you pull it out, and then you close the doors again, and you know, it needs to have the right amount of temperature, time, glass, blowing. There's all these, like, it looks super, just like hitting a home run, you know, on against a major league pitcher. It looks super easy. but, you know, it takes a real, true professional to be able to do it very well. And then, you know, they go in the kiln, and then they're essentially, we make one size for both the pint and the tumbler. And then once it's done, it goes into the kiln, and then it goes over to the hot popping shop, which is essentially they take the glass, and then it's on a spinning, almost record player type plate. And then there's a torch that goes on it, and they use a diamond, and they score it, which means they're just cutting the glass to the height that they want it to be, whether it's the tumbler or the pint. Okay. And they use this diamond, and it spins around, and then it'll cut this perfect line in it, and then they'll pop the top off. And then we have all these torches that look like lightsabers that are pointed at the rim of the glass, and those are utilized to smooth out the rim and to create the perfect lip. You know, and one thing that you know, I mean, these are all individually made. These aren't machine made in China or anything like that, and they all have their own little personality, their own perfections that make them each unique in their own way. You know, when they're done, everything gets done in the shop. They go back in the kiln, and then we're ready to rock. And we go through the process of evaluating to make sure they're up to our standards. And if they're good enough, they get shipped off to a lucky customer. And if they're not, we recycle them and make some more.
So you answered, I think you answered a question that I wanted to ask, and I was going to think maybe it was a silly question, but so we all have had a glass that we've broken. And so in the manufacturing process, you probably
every now and again glasses,
every now and again. Right. And so is that, this is either a really good question or a really dumb question. And I don't care if you tell me which it is, if the glass has been sort of cooled or tempered or whatever sort of the back end of the process is, could it then be, you know, almost literally swept off the floor and put back into sort of the slurry or the lava or the sort of the liquid glass mix? Or is that sort of, it's beyond use
nope.
at that point?
It can be used again. Absolutely. Because everything, it's so hot in there that everything else burns off. So it's just literally molten hot glass.
It is like the T-2000.
Oh, in Terminator 2. There are some globs I could show you pictures. It absolutely looks like that. It absolutely does. Yeah. And most of, you know, I would say that 40% of each glass is, Legend glass is recycled glass. You know, we're trying to be as eco-friendly as we can and trying to, you know, do good in these worlds. And that's the other benefit to having a glass as well, is that, you know, everyone's trying to do their part and be yep. good to the planet and all that good stuff. And, you know, glassware is something that you can use over and over and over and over again. Don't have to wear plastic, don't have to wear it wearing out. So that's another wonderful benefit.
How hard is it to perfect the logo? I mean, I really only care about the Alabama logo, but you guys have others, and we'll add additionals. How hard is it to perfect the logo sort of in the bottom of that? I'll call it a template, but how hard is that to perfect?
We call it the puck. It is not easy. I wish that every time we got a new skull, we just press a button and be like, okay, here's this one. Because each logo is so unique in its own way, and some work so well and some are super challenging. We also, for Alabama, since they were our first, we had to go through a couple of different processes. We 3D printed one. We had one machined. We went through, you know, it's all about, you know, making sure it holds true to the logo. Because the optics come into play as well, whether there's liquid in the glass or not, because there's a layer of glass on top of the actual logo that you see. Each logo is its own challenge. The big, bold, blocky ones, like, you know, the Oregon O, super good, easy. We just did FSU. That one was, we didn't do the Seminole. We did the written FSU. That one was its own challenge. Mm-hmm. We're actually doing the Oregon State Beavers now, and that one's very detailed and very, you know, it can't even be machined. It has to be 3D printed. So each one is its own little journey, and making sure that, you know, making sure it maintains the integrity of the logo, making sure it comes out very well. And you know, some of them are a little too detailed for us to do. Some might be too big of a challenge for us to accomplish, right. But it's a fun journey to try and figure them out. And you have to put vent holes in the bottom of them so it breathes properly. There's all these like little details of complications. As they say, glass is a fragile business, and it's true. We've had to go through many batches. So a lot of batches had to be like discarded because of some issue or something that's happened. So, you know, we're just trying to provide perfection so the end user like you, you know, only sees the beautiful.
Right. Right. Well, we appreciate that. These are, like I said, these are certainly cool. Talk to us. You know, you had mentioned a little bit earlier, about the licensing process and, you know, talk to me about that a little bit. I you know, even just in your early discussion, you know, I learned a little bit about, you know, you mentioned Learfield, and I'm used to hearing sort of Learfield sports. They own the Alabama, you know, Sports Network and Eli Gold and all of that stuff. But I'm probably not sure that I realized that they owned the licensing for the individual schools. And so there's a part of my brain that says, hey, if Learfield, for example, if they own multiple licenses for multiple schools, then that's almost, you know, one-stop shop or Occam's razor on getting a whole bunch of licenses. Sounds like maybe it doesn't quite work that way. Talk about that process. Maybe some interesting stories that we wouldn't know from the outside.
It is a journey. Well, Learfield, they're just this giant billion-dollar company, and they have bought up a lot of other little companies. You know, that's where the radio comes in. That's where IMG comes in. And they just recently also, I don't know, recently, they own the CLC, which is the Collegiate Licensing Company. Corporation. And that's the company we've always seen for years and years and years with the little holograms. When you buy a Crimson Tide shirt or whatever else, you see those little hologram stickers, and that's what they pay for. That's the licensing. But you would think that it would be super simple, but each school is its own animal. Each school has very, very passionate people that need to uphold the standards of their school. And some let you just like, okay, cool, let's get this going on. Let's make this happen. Other ones are just, no, we're going to need to see so much stuff. It's insane. It's just jump through so many hoops that it has become a little bit of a challenge on certain schools that we're like, okay, we'll talk to you in about a year. But for the, yeah, it, you know, and it really, it is unique. And that's why we chose college football first too, because as we discussed earlier, college football is who you are and professional teams are where you are. And we really, you know, having worked in college for so long, we wanted to appeal to that. And we could pick off individual schools and go for those ones first instead of just going, we got everybody or we have every NFL team. Okay, let's go do that. So as far as, you know, I wouldn't say anything funny about it except the pain that we've gone through trying to get each one of these licenses and just push it forward and get our decks together and just get the models. And the biggest challenge is explaining the unexplainable when we're going for new schools and we're trying to explain that we have created this product that is unique. Oftentimes like, well, it's drinkware, it's not unique. So they'll shut it down without even realizing what we're talking about. So I've had to go back to so many schools and be like, okay, hey, listen, actually, it sounds familiar, but it's a little unique. Let me send you these so you can take a look. Sorry, they're from your rival, but that's how for yeah, because we for Washington, University of Washington, they denied us. And I was like, well, you want to check out the Oregon Duck ones and see how you think it is? She's like, oh, yeah, for sure. Because you got to keep up with the Joneses, you know? And they're like, these are great. We need to be involved. So we got them going on as well. But yeah, it's been fun. It's been fun. We're looking forward to, you know, with us, we just want to cover all the bases. So when it's such a great gift that even if you're a passionate Alabama fan or the other school that's in Alabama, you know, you can share this with someone you care about, even though you might have different sports views, because it's just so sure. Such a cool and unique gift.
Absolutely. I was looking at your website and with the teams that you offer, which reminds me, I need to talk to someone, because previously Alabama was, you know, you look under products and teams, Alabama was in the first spot, And I noticed we've been repositioned to the second spot. So, you know, Florida State's here. So I don't know who to talk to, who we need to talk to that about that. But maybe we put them in alphabetical order or something like that.
I think so. I'll call IT.
But it looks like, you know, it looks like you guys have added FSU in Miami. You've got a couple of schools sort of on the way. You know, I probably want to spin you know, questions a couple of different ways. You're a Florida guy.
I started
right?
my collegiate career at the University of Florida. Yes, a long time ago.
So you and I, we're good for a couple of weeks, and then we'll have to take a couple of days off, and then we'll be good again. but that's how that works, right? But how does it bug you a little bit that you've got the FSU in Miami, but you don't yet have the Gators there? They're in the works, right?
They're definitely in the works. And you know, now relocating to the Pac-12, I learned a lot going to the University of Florida. Football is a completely different animal in the SEC. It is so different. It is not even funny. I mean, I think the SEC gets it. I don't know if the Pac-12 gets it, but there is passion like nothing else in the SEC. It is crazy. And that was like what my time at Florida definitely taught me. Is just how rabid those fans are and how seriously they take it. I've heard some stories. Woof. But Florida's definitely in the cards. We're picking and choosing, you know, and the reason we've wound Alabama was first, Oregon was second, and the rest of them just are falling into place as the licensing companies approve them or the schools approve them. So we're just at the mercy of all these schools. We've submitted applications so long ago that we're just waiting to hear back. So as luck would have it, Florida State's just like, okay, here you go. Like, all right, chop, chop, chop.
So the FSU, like you said, is just the script, sort of FSU. And when I think of Florida, they have a script F that they use sometimes, not a whole lot. It's more of sort of the Gator. That might be a more challenging logo to put it in a glass. And I'm thinking your process. I'm not talking football. But the process of getting that in the bottom of the glass, begrudgingly, I would say that would be a good-looking glass. But that might be a tougher logo. Is that fair?
Absolutely. That's why the Beavers is the first time we've actually ventured into the animal mascot realm. So this is really the test. Like each one we do is kind of a building block. Each logo we do is a building block for the next one. And so far we've been trying to stick towards the big bold letters, you know, to just get those figured out. So now we're heading into a little more complicated territory with this beaver. And if we can pull this one off, it's sky's the limit. No, that gator would look great in the bottom of a glass for sure.
All right. Easy
now. Yeah. I mean, it would still probably be in third place or fourth place in the SEC, but you know, it would still look good.
So I'm going to ask an unfair question, and I get this is an unfair question. So you guys are ramping up. These tumblers are phenomenal. I don't yet have some of the pints, but, you know, I'm sure that those are equally as cool. And so where you're sitting, you're like, let's continue to refine this process, these glasses. There's 100 more schools that we'd like to go with. Oh, there you go. I see what you did there. Very nice. And you're probably thinking there's 100 more schools that we'd like to add on and sort of roll out that way. That's probably the right answer. But the impatient part of me says, gosh, what's next? What's the next cool Alabama thing that you guys are? And so you could say, look, we're not that far along. And that's probably a good answer. But what are you thinking in terms of what might be next? Future forward think question?
No. I mean, we would really love to expand the options for each school. We looked at doing a little bit of the elephant. Mm-hmm. We've also done some prototypes with some stuff on the side. We're kind of mixing it up. The thing is that just the A is just so strong and is just such a recognizable image. We're open to suggestions. What do you got? Yeah, the A. Oh yeah,
the walking.
Yeah, A. Yeah, the classic. Yeah.
Now that's challenging.
Oh yeah.
That would be challenging.
I'm in
an age demographic that we identify with the walking A, but the script A, I do like. Don't do the back. Don't do the Bob Bockroth urgent elephant.
Okay.
You won't sell anything.
Okay.
But the walking A is cool, and the script A, we all love the script.
The
A.
The script A is where it's at, and that would be if we did a second one. The walking A would be your request.
Well, I mean, if you're taking requests,
always,
yes.
Always. We love to hear from the people.
Fantastic. What do you want to tell us that I didn't ask? What question did I not ask?
You know, at the end of the day, really what we're going for here is we just want to brighten people's worlds up. And there was a major issue with us when every single sports memorabilia merchandise that we saw said the same thing on it, no matter what team it was. It said made in China, yep. Made in China, made in China, made in China. And which is fine. Most things we buy but we are American sports. We should have quality American made sports products, things you can be proud of, things that are unique, things that are exclusive to America. And we really set out to do that. Something you can count on, the quality, you know where it's made, it supports American workers. That was very, very important to us. And especially these days, you know, I mean, job security is, it's just, you know, it's on everybody's mind. Anybody who's a diehard fan like yourself who finds out about these or sees them or gets it in their hands, their jaw drops. They just cannot believe it. And especially in this holiday season, gifts are, you know, this is the time. And it's so rare when you have these people in your lives for so long. It's this challenge. What am I going to get them this year? Oh, man, I got to, you know, you have to get gifts every year for these people. And it's so hard to pull out that home run gift, that very extra special one where people are like, how did this happen? Where did this come from? This is the greatest. Right. This is unbelievable. It's so rare that you get that. You know, we get some cooking stuff or you get something for the bar. This is nice. You know, something for the grill. This is nice. This is fun. But to get that jaw dropping, oh my gosh, this is super freaking cool. I can't believe I didn't know about this. That doesn't happen very often. And what this does.
That was the thought bubble. I think that was a direct sort of quote or text from the thought bubble above my head when I first saw it. I was like, I've got to have these. I'm sorry. I cut you off, but that sounded very familiar. I identified with what you said.
Yeah. And it's just, you know, it's everything's been done these days. And to have something new and fresh at a cost that is a premium product, but for the use you get out of it, for the years of enjoyment you're going to get out of it, it's a small price to pay. For the quality, craftsmanship, and American-made passion that went into it, it's a small price to pay. And when you give this gift to someone and you see their face when they pull it out from under the tree and they're just mystified of what this is, they see the label, they're like, what? And then they unwrap it and they're like, this is the coolest thing in the world. I'll be right back. I got to go fix my glass.
That's right. Have the eggnog ready when you start opening gifts. You're ready to go.
Their minds are going to be blown. So we're just really trying to get out there and just get in front of people and show them something new and amazing that exists.
Fantastic. Stefan, these glasses are truly, I think, as unique as fans are. They're unique as, you know, everyone identifies with their team almost at a visceral level. And these glasses, unlike sort of the made in China stamped off the assembly line kind of thing, these glasses sort of scratch that itch in a way that other gifts don't. And so I think you guys have definitely hit a home run here in terms of, you know, what you've got for the Alabama fan base and other fan bases as well. We certainly appreciate your affiliation with our podcast, and we certainly appreciate you hopping on with us today to share a little bit of the Legends Drinkware story. Folks, jump out and grab them for holiday gifts. Check out legendsdrinkware.com. You can use code AFB10 for 10% off. And if they're running a sort of a different or better discount, then use that and find a field where you can tell them that we told you about them. But go get some drink glasses for yourself and your friends and family, and you'll certainly appreciate it.
Thanks so much. Roll Tide.
Roll Tide. Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. Fantastic. Welcome back. Let's flip the field and talk Alabama defense. We're breaking down Alabama LSU 55-17 dismantling. And the number that's going to stand out to a lot of people is that 17 points allowed. That's going to be, to some people, they're going to allow that to be evidence that the defense, just stop it. Would you just stop it? 17 points allowed by the Alabama defense on Saturday was the most since Alabama allowed, ironically, also 17 points to Tennessee. And you think, man, that Tennessee game was a long time ago. You're right. It was. It was four games ago. But on the clock, it was about 6 weeks ago because of the bye weeks. Or it's about half a season ago. And so Alabama has not allowed 17 points in approximately half the duration of the season, which is kind of impressive. And so allowing 17 points, we've talked about LSU being an athletic team, a capable team. Hey, they're on scholarship too. And so the fact that they scored 17 should not be the end of our world. But let's dive into those 17 points a little bit. Two of the touchdowns, so 14 of the 17, came on big plays. And so I don't like Alabama giving up big plays, but they're singular plays. They're not a systemic, continued breakdown of the defensive performance. They're singular, isolated events that just happen to yield big plays. And so let's look at this, right? The two big plays, one was a pass, one was a run. If you accumulate the yardage on those two plays, and it was 97, 98 yards. I added it up earlier. I don't have it right in front of me. But I did pulled out the calculator, did the math. The yardage on those two plays represents 28% of LSU's total offense. If you listen to Saban in his postgame, he sort of breaks it down and he gets into more sort of technical speak, if you will. But, he talks about, hey, it was a gap fill on a run. And so we missed a gap fill in the running back. It was well blocked. We missed a gap fill. They have a talented running back. He ran it in for a touchdown. And on the pass, it was a miscommunicated. It was a change of call. They had some motion. They realigned, and so we were going to turn off the corner blitz. So we were going to corner blitz. They shuffled their personnel, and we turned off the corner blitz. And everyone knew about it except for the corner who blitzed. And so Joshua blitzed, and he was not back to cover the wide receiver. And so you have a wide open wide receiver. And you think those are very singular plays and easily correctable. And when you play a sort of a live fire opponent, sometimes just being a little bit off, and this is why Saban is so precise on the execution, get it right and practice it, not just to get it right, but practice it so you can't get it wrong. And which is aspirational, but that's the goal. And so when there's that kind of edge and you appreciate that there's that kind of edge and someone breaks a play, it doesn't represent sort of the end of the world. It represents we had a singular miss. I use these examples with regularity. I think back to a Va-Tech game probably 7 years ago where Alabama defense is thoroughly dominating the Hokies. But on one play, a linebacker is a step and a half out of position and the Hokies bust an 80-yard run for a touchdown. That's because the linebacker isn't square in the hole. He's a step and a half lateral. He's a step and a half, body, his belly button's turning towards the sidelines instead of the line of scrimmage, and he's a step and a half away. Well, if he's able to make that step and a half, get in place and have his belly button facing the line of scrimmage, he makes a tackle in the hole. It's a 2-yard gain, not an 80-yard gain. And so that's an example I use. I like to use the D. Milliner example, his freshman year against Arkansas. He gave up a big, 80-yard touchdown because he bit on a fake and then got beat over the top. Well, he never got beat like that again over the rest of his career, right? It wasn't an example of, he's a ratty player, he shouldn't be out there. No, it's let's learn this lesson and not do it again. And that was true for the Alabama run defense in nearly almost for the entirety of the rest of the season, because that was game one. And it was certainly true for D. Milliner, who went on to be an All-America at Alabama. It was true for him the rest of his career, right? And so why can't that be true for this defense as well? And in fact, I think it is. I think it will be. We didn't see very many other big plays from LSU. Look, they're talented. They're going to move the ball between the 20s, maybe kick a field goal. But those are two touchdowns you could reason that they shouldn't have had. And I'll split the distance with you. If we force them to punt off of one and they drive down and score on another, then that's going to be, that's legit as well. But when you look at 17, let's understand what that 17 means. I'm also gonna, and this is not excuse making, but this is facts. These are the facts. Alabama had three sideline assistant coaches not available for the game. We could look at, and look, this is Freddie Roach, defensive lineman, Sal Cenceri, linebacker, and Carl Scott, the cornerback coach. Now, are technically is Carl in the box? I probably as a corner coach. The point is, though, these are the position coaches, and we missed one at each level for the game. And I'm gonna go so far as to reason this: Saban missed last week, right? And missing out on Saban at the game, that's a big deal. But in the moment, you know, Saban is guiding the ship. He is guiding. He's the captain, you know, on the mast, guiding, you know, the ship. If the bar is out of cognac, that's not the captain's fault, right? That's the bar manager's fault, right? And so you can be responsible for the entirety of the operation. But if there's a slip in a specific location, that's not necessarily the fault of the captain of the ship, the head coach. I'm butchering a bad example. My point is this: Saban being out is a big deal, but in the heat of the action, in the flow of the game, the position coaches that are talking to their units, talking to their guys every play, every between plays, they're going back to the whiteboard between it. What did you guys see out there? Okay, how we're going to adjust on this? They're having those live fire conversations with the players. To have the position coach at each of the different levels of the defense out for this game, I'm going to say for those players, that's a bigger deal than Saban missing the game last week, because the flow of the game. How many players on the team do you think talk to Saban during the course of the game? Not very many. In fact, most of them probably don't want to talk to him during a game, because it's a very animated conversation. And so you think about, oh, you're going to take away a coach that, I mean, I like the coach, but I'd really rather not have to talk to him on game day. And I usually never talk to him on game day. Am I going to miss that guy, or am I going to miss my position coach that I talk to between, not every play, but between every possession? We sit down and whiteboard this shit. Who are you going to miss more on game day? You're going to miss the position coaches. And so I think all of that sort of congeals into, yeah, 17 sucks, but I'm not going to lose sleep over this, right? Because, you know, this is what we call reasons, not excuses. So I'm not going to belabor that anymore, but I would say this: if you're down on the Alabama defense and you're down on Pete Golding, I ain't going to fix that, but this is not the collapse you're looking for. I'll say that. Individual performances on the defense. Will Anderson continues to emerge. He had two sacks on the day. Is this a crack the seal moment on Will Anderson? Let's see what the rest of the season holds. I think potentially so. Christian Harris continues to be just incredibly active. He had seven tackles and half a sack on the day. Any number of players you want to call out, Josh Jobe, Malachi, Daniel Wright, before he had to sit down. Barmore had a sack. PS2 had, I don't know how he was only credited with one deflection, but he was like sticky tape all day covering the receivers. Just a lot of players on the Alabama defense continue to perform well. I know a lot of people are not really pleased with Dylan Moses's play. I've sort of not ventured into those waters, although I don't entirely disagree. But I tell you what Dylan is doing that, and you know, we kind of predicted this too, that he was going to be the cheat code for Christian Harris. Christian Harris was going to be better sort of all by himself, second year in the system, sort of learning the ins and outs, but that he was going to play with a higher level of confidence, a higher level of comfort with Dylan being out there, and that the presence of Dylan would help amplify Christian Harris's production and performance. I think this is true. I think that continues to be true. I stand by that. And I don't think that's just me trying to sort of carry water for Dylan Moses. I just think there's truth to it. And that's where my head is there. I think when we think about this Alabama defense, there's an adjustment. There's a mentality tune-up that I think probably a lot of fans could benefit from. when we think about the 2020 Alabama defense, and our first inclination is to compare it to the 2011 or the 2012 defense, I'd suggest you're doing it wrong. That's the easy comparison. It is not an illogical comparison, but it's the wrong comparison. Because guess what? We're not going to suit up. I don't think they've adjusted the schedule in such a way that this Alabama team is going to line up and have to play the 2011 Alabama defense. I don't think they've figured that out yet. So to compare them to that team is an interest to those defenses and is an interesting exercise, but it's the wrong exercise. It's a frustrating exercise. It will lead to frustration. Here's the comparison we need to look for. Now, this one's a little trickier. It's not pure just apples and apples. There is a little bit of apples to pears sort of conversation here, but it's not in an inappropriate way. We need to look at, can this Alabama defense impact an opponent's offense more than that opponent's defense can impact Alabama's offense? And so that's not a one-to-one, you just kind of look at them side by side. That's a layered, more complex comparison. But let's just play with Florida a little bit because they're coming up and we all kind of got them on our minds. So Alabama's defense doesn't play Florida's defense. Alabama's defense is going to play Florida's offense. And so can Alabama's defense stifle? Let's assume the offenses are equal. I don't think they are, but let's assume so you can sort of play with the point a little bit. Let's assume Alabama's offense and Florida's offense are the same. Again, I don't think they are, but let's play with me a little bit. If they're the same, then the question becomes the defense. Whose defense can have a greater impact on the opponent's offense? Could Alabama's defense tamp down Florida's offense more than the vice versa? Florida's defense and Alabama's offense, right? And so it's sort of a cross-pollination type conversation. And I don't think my explanation clarified as much as I would like sort of the point that I'm getting at. But I think the offenses aren't equal, right? I think Alabama's potentially dynamic in both the passing and the running. I think Florida is more dynamic passing and probably more anemic rushing. And so you could reason it's an easier task for the Alabama defense. But can Alabama defense stifle Florida's offense more than Alabama's offense can be stifled by Florida's defense? And I think that's the comparison. That's the real comparison. And it's a harder comparison. You know, when you're comparing it to these other Alabama teams, you're comparing that outcome. And we don't know the outcome from all of the games and all of the opponents with this defense in this season. So at any rate, I probably butchered that and I probably belabored that more than I wanted to, but you got to look at it. I think for my money, I have to look at it the right way. I try to want to look at it the right way. And so you have to compare what can this defense do against another offense. And I mean, there's some questions there. How do we cover? And we'll get into this maybe at a different point. But how do we cover those guys? And how do we take some of the air out of the ball, or how do we take some of the air out of the Florida offense? And I think this defense can do that to them more consistently, or enough more to create a differential that's positive for Alabama. I don't think Florida's defense can completely do that to Alabama because it's just too dynamic in too many different ways. All right, I'll stop talking about that. We'll do a Florida show later. But again, the key to the defense is making the right comparison. And let's make the right comparison when we think about the Alabama defense. All right, mini game ball for the LSU game, because we are talking about the LSU game. I'm going to DeMarco Helms. I have liked me some DeMarco Helms. We've sort of settled into a rotation the Alabama team has where Helms comes in. He's the strong safety. It's a weird sort of thing. He's a strong safety that he doesn't come in and nickel. He doesn't come in and he comes in. He's part of the base four, But he's the backup. He's the backup for Daniel Wright. And so he doesn't come in. I think early in the season, before Brian Branch sort of developed himself, he was coming in dime packages. And so now he's not coming in at dimes. But we do change, you know, typically in the third quarter, we change our defensive backs. And so we rotate Daniel Wright out and we rotate in DeMarco Hellams. And so the other primary starters play with both Daniel Wright and DeMarco Hellams. It's just an inflection point in the game. And so what's interesting, and the fact that we've done that the last couple of weeks actually made losing Daniel Wright to maybe a suspect targeting call against LSU, it made the transition, it made sort of the loss of Daniel Wright much more seamless than it otherwise would have been, because we've done this sort of weird thing where we've rotated safeties in the third quarter. I don't know. At any rate, DeMarco Hellams came into the game much, much earlier than he otherwise would have and played, you know, many more snaps. I don't have a snap count to break down necessarily, but he played a lot more reps than he otherwise would have. And I thought he acquitted himself very, very well. For my money, he's a very physical player. And he made a couple of very physical tackles while he was in the game, and that was certainly fun to watch. So hats off to DeMarco Hellams. He's going to be sort of a tricky player next year when we say, oh, we've lost so many guys from our secondary, whatever that number is, hopefully not as big as it could be. And then we're going to roll DeMarco Hellams in there and say, oh, and people are going to go nuts over we're replacing so many guys, and DeMarco Hellams hasn't played a whole lot. And the truth is he will have. He'll be a stabilizing force on the team next year, not dissimilar to what he's doing this year. So anyways, I run on, but DeMarco Hellams, mini game ball. So special teams. Oh, my favorite stat line of the day came from special teams. Ooh, can you guess? Alabama had zero kick returns. Alabama had zero punt returns. Oh, we took the ball where they gave it to us. I like that. And so that, I think, is my favorite stat line on the entire day. There were no kick returns for Alabama. And sometimes that's fun because if the, you know, that counts punts too, right? And so if you're not getting any kickoffs, I mean, you're always going to get one. But if you're not getting any kickoffs, you know, that typically can mean that the other team isn't scoring. LSU scored three times and a kick to open one of the halves. And so that's four, but we had 0 yards of return. And of course, no punt returns. We're taking the ball where they give it to us. And then especially on punts, their punts were a little shorter. And so we were letting them drop and sort of be covered. But I think we realized, hey, let's play it a little safe on some of the punt return guys because we're thin in those areas. And anyways, I just got a kick out of seeing no quick returns, no punt returns. So that may have been not literally my favorite stat of the day, but the most fun stat for me of the day. We'll say that. Will Reichert, man, what do you not want to say about this guy? He's phenomenal. 7-of-7 on the PATs, 2-of-2 on field goals. Had a couple of weeks where maybe he hasn't kicked a field goal. He had a long of 34, which is not, you know, an incredibly long kick. But here is what's amazing about Will Reichert. And we talked about this on the Zoom call a little bit. And I'm not exactly sure who said this, but someone made the comment, and I'm going to sort of repurpose it. Someone made the comment that, hey, you know, Reichert's kicks are all down Main Street. I think Clint said this. You know, all of Reichert's kicks are right down Main Street. And that got me thinking sort of like, you know, like a golfer, right? And so, well, the ball's going to go sort of kind of in that direction, but is it going to hook? Is it going to slice? And so you think of like a scatter shot. Well, if you kick enough of them, you know, some of them are going to go through their uprights and some of them aren't. And maybe we don't know which is which when ball and foot connect. And that, to me, sort of summarizes the last couple of years at the kicking position. And Reichert, on the other hand, this is true on his PATs. This is true on his kicks. They go down Main Street. They are line drives. There's an urgency that ball has in getting to and through the uprights. And that's exciting to see. That feels like, hey, we have a kicker that knows what they're doing and what their intent is, because they are unleashing. They're not questioning which way the ball is going to go. They know which way it's going to go, and they're letting the leg go and kicking those line drives. They've seen, I saw this on Tighter Insider earlier today, a poster commenting about why don't we have anyone that can kick it, you know, in, on kickoffs, you know, out of the back of the end zone. Why are we only kicking it, you know, to the five? I think we're doing that intentionally. I continue to stand by that. I think that's strategy. I'm not suggesting that I agree with the strategy, but I understand it. And then let's just say that that's not strategy. Let's just say that Chase Allen's getting a lot of the work on the kickoffs. Let's just say that Chase Allen can't kick it out of the end zone and kicking it to the five is absolutely the best that he could do. You could reason then, do we need to find someone like a Will Reichert? And he's doing some kickoffs too, but not all of them. We want to take Will Reichert and we want him to do kickoffs as well. Because maybe he more accurately or more consistently can get them into the end zone. I think that'd be a reasonable conversation. But I'd say this, and I'm, you know, it's a conversation. It's the endless conversation about protecting a player from injury. And should we think about this? I'm just putting this on the table. Reichert, who Saban has, you know, publicly said he thinks is the best kicker in the country. And he felt that last year. Just Reichert couldn't, Reichert was injured and couldn't play as much last season. We recall how he was injured. He was injured on a kickoff, not a field goal, not a PAT. He was injured on a kickoff where he kicked the, it was not the stand, but sort of the, whatever the holder, and not the personal holder, but sort of the holder that you put the ball on to kick it off. He kicked that. And that caused him to injure his sort of hip flexor. And you think about, oh, well, then why the hell do we have him doing that? Let's not have him do that because he's more important on these kicks, on these field goals, having him available for field goals. And so maybe we have him kick, you know, just a little bit to sort of loosen up and stay competent and capable on the kickoffs. But let's not make that his primary thing. His primary thing or the field goals and PATs. Maybe I'm overthinking that a little bit. That's fine. But I think it's a strategy that we kick to the five. And I think there might be some intention in splitting kicking duties for just what we're talking there. All right. Next up, Arkansas. And so, you know what? I think there's a lot of sort of folks. This is interesting, right? Because where are people's heads and are they rationalizing all the available data sets, right? It's been easy to sort of laugh at the ACC for canceling games to sort of preserve Notre Dame and Clemson, their opportunity to get two into the playoffs. It's easy right now to sort of laugh at the Big Ten that maybe they're changing some of the rules to preserve Ohio State's opportunity. There's also the other side of the coin. There's been some wonder, hey, why does the SEC do that? Why don't we cancel these games, you know, next week? And just do what the Big Ten is doing, even though we're laughing, not the Big Ten, the ACC, even though we're laughing at the ACC, maybe we should do what they're doing. And what's interesting, and, you know, and then you juxtapose that with when the SEC, it just means more. So we're going to play these games. But what's interesting, and Dan, this is good strategy. What's interesting is, hey, SEC's already kind of stacked the deck, right? Remember when they added the two games, they went to 10 and they added the two games. You remember who Florida got, or you remember, you know, Florida. You remember who Georgia got, you remember who Alabama got. And so when you think of sort of how are we going to stack the deck, we're going to do it less blatantly than just canceling a game. And we're going to do it early enough that kind of everyone forgets about it. And so while everyone's sort of pointing fingers and laughing at ACC and Big Ten and then quietly saying, why don't we do the same things they're doing? The SEC, where it just matters more, I think we're going to play those games. And the SEC, where maybe we've got this shit figured out more than others, we've already done our deck stacking. And all you media guys have forgotten about it. And so that's cool. Kind of like that. I kind of like that. So, look, what's going to happen is going to happen. We're gonna play the Hogs. I think Arkansas has been a pretty good story this season. You think about Sam Pittman and such. I think it's been an interesting sort of story. But what's interesting is, you know, they started out 3-3, and now they're 3-6. They dropped three in a row. Funny how these things sometimes happen. They're right back to where kind of everyone predicted them to be, near the bottom, at the bottom of the SEC West. So sitting at 3-6, I don't know what Mississippi State is. They're going to be down there too, but they're going to be, you know, they're going to be at the bottom, towards the bottom of the SEC West, which turns out, you know, that was a prediction, and that's pretty much where they are. This Arkansas team, like I said, great story. Like Sam Pittman, they're overmatched, and I think Sam would tell you that. He loves his players and he's a player coach, but I think he's going to tell you that. They've lost to Auburn. It's a team that we took pretty good care of. They lost to Texas A&M. In fact, they allowed 42 points to Texas A&M. They lost to LSU, and I think we have a recollection here of what we did to LSU. And they lost to Missouri on Saturday. So that's current. They lost to Missouri on Saturday. They gave up 50 points to said Missouri team. All of that in the heat of the battle, because that game went down to late in the fourth quarter. I think Alabama score allowed 17, 24 maybe to Missouri. And there was some angst over that, but they scored most of those points after the game was effectively over. And Missouri scored 50 points on Arkansas. Like I said, sort of the heat of the contest. I mentioned three straight losses. They went from 3-3 to 3-6. And so you wonder if the wheels have fallen off the train there. All of that coming off the LSU game, coming off an Arkansas team that I don't think will tank. I think will play hard, but they are beat, battered, and ready to be done, I think is a fair assessment as well. And so if you take all of that together and distill it together and you're like, how big of a number are you going to have in your prediction? I'm going to surprise every one of you. My prediction for this game is 38-10. My prediction for this game, and it's one of those things that Saban would throw his shoe at me if he heard me say it, but from the confines of my home office, from the security of my fandom, I think this is a game that you look at and you say, where can we get some guys some rest? Where can we have guys at a lower injury potential going into the SEC championship game against a tougher opponent against Florida? We're getting to this point where, hey, we've started to play multiple games in a row here. Now that we're back, we potentially are going to have multiple games to play here in a row with Arkansas and in Florida. Where is there an opportunity to take some snaps away from some of the starters? And I think we actively do that. What is a game plan that gets us to getting the starters out midway through the third quarter? And I think we do that, you know, can we get 28 points in the first half and then maybe slide into some backups? And again, it's that conversation that if someone's going to ask Saban this week, and he's going to throw rocks at him. And I think that's my prediction. I think Arkansas is going to be competitive. They get an early field goal and a late touchdown. Probably sounds right. And does Alabama sort of call the dogs off early, not wanting to? I mean, we have no beef with Arkansas, not like we did LSU. And so do we call the dogs off maybe a little bit and rotate some guys in earlier and often, maybe getting them some reps for a playoff stretch, maybe taking some miles, some mileage off some of the primary guys? Yeah, I think we look to do something like that. And so when we think about the Arkansas game, for my money, that's the key thing to look for. When do we start rotating and who do we start rotating? I think that's going to be an interesting thing to watch. And so when you look at all these games we've been scoring, you know, 40 and 50 in a 63-point game, oh my God, what are we going to do these Hogs? We're going to be eating brisket at halftime. And all of that, you know, probably there's some truth to it, but this one's going to stick out like a thumb. Like, huh, Alabama scored 38 points against Arkansas. What's up with that? Well, it's going to be about where do we rotate guys in? And so that's going to be something to watch for when we think about the Arkansas game. All right, so one more thing I want to cover, and that is the Legends Drinkware Contest. Look, we're running a contest. You guys know this. These are the coolest, slickest glasses, I think, that are available. We're running through this one last game. We're going to do got our second contest going up. And I said something sort of kind of off the cuff last week, and the more I think about it, the more I'm going to do it. So we have a number of entries in. It's not a huge number, so the odds are still in your favor. I'd like to get 5 more entries into the contest. That'll get us to a number. And if we get 5 more entries into the contest, what's interesting is everyone that has sent me an entry, they've mentioned a player, and I'm like, oh, I love that player. Here's what I think about that player. Here's like my initial thought on that player. And so to me, that's been so much fun. I'm thinking if we get 5 more entries, that'll be, you know, potentially 5 new different players, and that'll give us a sort of a hefty sort of collection of players. And I'll do a bonus show where we just talk about everyone's entry and sort of my favorite recollections with those players. I've mentioned this before. We all sort of have our own sort of Hall of Fame, our personal halls of fame for Alabama players. And what greater, more fun thing is it to do to sit around and talk with other Alabama fans about their favorite players, right? And sort of exchange notes and stories and, oh, you like that guy for this reason. I like him for this reason. And do sort of that comparative sort of thing. And so every time somebody has sent me a player, I've enjoyed like, oh, that's so cool. You like him for that reason. I kind of like him for this reason, which is kind of like yours and kind of maybe a little different, kind of something else. And so I thought, wouldn't it be cool if we had, you know, 15 or 20 sort of players, entries, still a low number, still great odds to win. But then that becomes sort of the meat, the backbone of a sort of a fun, you know, playoff season, holiday season show where we're just shooting the shit about some of our favorite players. So let's get five more entries in, and I will do that show, and we'll put that in the works. So again, I think that's what we've got. Yep, that's what we got for today. So you know what to do. Roll Tide. This has been another edition of the Alabama Football Podcast. Roll Tide.
Thanks for listening to the Alabama Football Podcast. We love that you're tuned in and hope that you enjoyed the show. We encourage you to reach out and let us know what you like, where we can improve, or just a shout out, a Roll Tide. We are where you are. iTunes, Facebook, Twitter, email newsletters, t-shirts, free roster downloads, and of course, on the web at alabamafootballpodcast.com. Check us out where you'll find easy links to your favorite way to follow the Tide. Got that, Coach?
Aye.
Of course. Roll Tide.